So last week, everyone, we started looking at the proto-Shaiva groups, the posture patterns and the Lakunishas, and we're now moving on to the Shaiva Siddhanta and the Tantric Shaiva traditions of medieval India. And we'll do this for this week and next week, and then after that we'll move on to more recent things, popular traditions, and in Hinduism and modernity. So the Tantric Shaiva traditions, just carrying on from last week. Yeah, this is just to recap briefly what we did last time. So you've got these three classes of texts, Veda, Purana and Tantra. The Veda is the early text that we looked at last term, and the philosophical articulation is the Mimamsakas, with the exegesis and Nyaya, the logicians. And then you get these Puranic texts, which we looked at, which are devotional, narrative, mythological texts to do with the gods Vishnu, Shiva and the goddess. And you get orthodox worship of those deities, Brahmanical orthodox worship. And a group of Brahmins called the Smartas. We looked at that. And then you get this Tantric worship, which is non-Puranic worship of these same deities. There is some overlap between the Puranas and the Tantras. So the Agni Purana, for example, and the Skanda Purana contains material which is very identical material to some Tantric texts.
Why is it non-Puranic?
The mantras. They have Tantric mantras, whereas the Puranas don't have Tantric mantras.
Or do they have just text?
The Puranas have got mantras, but they're not. They don't have the Tantric mantras. They have just on Namah Shivaya. So the Tantric mantras are characterized by these bijas, Hum, Pat, Krim, Krim, Krim.
Sorry, the other ones, the other mantras are what?
The Puranic mantras are just ordinary from the Vedas and from the Om Namah Shivaya.
Yeah, I see.
And the Tantric mantras add these bijas, these seed syllables.
Could you say a bit more about that? The bijas mantras.
Bijas. Bijas means seed. Seed.
In what way is that different from Om Namah Shivaya, for example?
Namaha Om Namash Kogu Sandhi. Om Namah Shivaya or Om Namaha Shivaya, you've got two choices there, means homage to Shiva. But if and that's just a standard classical mantra, but if in a Tantric context you put Hum or Pat, and these are seed syllables. Bijas, bija or seed syllable.
Which are meaningless or?
Yeah, meaningless.
Symbolic.
Okay. And then so the body, the sharira, that's the body of the mantra, and this is the seed of the mantra, the seeds of the Hum. So the pinda, or the. So, when we talk about mantras, perhaps before next week. So you get non-Puranic worship, which is comprises these two paths. I couldn't draw a diagram, but there's a sort of two lines. Oh, dear. The Atimarga was the higher path, or the outer path, which is non-Tantric in a sense, because it's proto-Tantric. They don't revere the Tantras. But they've got their own scriptures called the Pashupata Sutras, and there were these ascetics who had these temples and were quite a powerful group in medieval India. And one extreme group of the Pashupatas were the Lakunishas, and then the Kalamukhas and the Karpalikas. We talked about those last week. They cover themselves in cremation ground ashes, who behaved in a dissonant way. And the Mantra Marga, the path of mantras, is the Tantric tradition, really. Because the path of mantras reveals the Tantras as revelation. This is their indigenous classification. And there are the mantra marga itself, which is divided into two main divisions, according to Abhinav Gupta, the Shaiva Siddhanta, which is what we're going to look at today, and the non-Siddhanta text, sometimes called Kashmir Shaivism, but it's beyond Kashmir as well. And these revere tantras which are dualistic, which means that they make, that there's a distinction between the self and the God, and the non-Siddhantika tantras believe that there was just one reality. And these more extreme tantras, as we'll see next week, disrupted Vedic values. So there's a degree of conformity to the Vedas, to the Brahmanical values of conformity to Dharma, Varna, Ashrama, Dharma. Your Dharma with regard to your Varna, your caste, and your Ashrama, your stage of life.
Where does the Pancharatra actually fit between the two?
The Pancharatra is tantric worship of Vishnu.
Okay.
So I didn't know where to actually stick it on that diagram, so I'll put it there. Because it conforms to the Vedic values, and it distances itself from the Shaiva revelation, because it says we have a revelation, but it's the Shaivas are wicked, but the Pancharatra is true. And the Puranic Orthodox worship of Shiva in Ramanuja that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, his teacher argued for the authenticity of the Pancharatra revelation, Yamuna. But Ramanuja himself doesn't refer much to the Pancharatra. But it was the standard ritual performed in the temples there. Now the tantras, these were texts composed between the 8th and 11th centuries, and they claim to be revelation, agama, that's which has come down to us. And they claim to go beyond the Veda, and they're composed in various traditions. So there's Buddhist tantras, Shaiva tantras, Shakta, goddess tantras, Vaishnava tantras, which is the Pancharatra, Saura sun tantras, and Garuda. Now all the sun tantras have been lost except one discovered recently by Divakaracharya, who was here a couple of terms ago. But there's and Jain tantras, I didn't put Jains in, of course the Jain tantras are another vast body of literature. And they're concerned with practice, sadhana. The Garuda tantras are concerned with snake bite, curing snake bites and magical possession. There's a whole range here, from quite sophisticated philosophy right through to just magical practices, mantras for keeping, curing snake bites and things like that. And their main concern is not so much philosophy, but practice, sadhana, to achieve liberation, mukti or moksha, and also magical powers, siddhi, and pleasure in higher worlds, bhukti or bhoga. In contrast to the more pure orthodox tradition, which was concerned with moksha. And there's said to be four feet that the tantras are based on: jnana, doctrine, yoga, ritual, kriya, and behaviour, charya. Now, not all tantras contain all of these. And some tantras assume, sections about knowledge, and they assume that these other things are dealt with in other texts. And the tantric groups in the medieval period became very popular and got royal patronage. And this was right the way through from the sort of 10th, 11th century, right the way through to the medieval period, really. It was later medieval period, early modern period. Until the advent of the Mughal Empire, the Muslims came in, and that was put pay to the tantric traditions. But they also existed in Southeast Asia as well. The Khmer kingdoms were fundamentally tantric kingdoms. So the kings in medieval India, the Cholas in the south, the Chalukyas, worshipped Shiva and got Brahmins, tantric Brahmins, to consecrate them and empower them. And Vijayanagara, right the way through to the 14th, 15th centuries. So the Vijayanagara king at Hampi would sit at the top of a tower and receive power from the goddess, would come down to him once a year, and everyone would come and pay homage to him. So the energy, the Shakti, would come from Durga into him, and then he would spread that power to his the lesser kings. So that was quite important, the royal patronage of these groups. And there was a distinction between the Maheshwaras, who were the orthodox worshippers of Shiva, the Puranic worshippers, and the Shaivas, who were initiated into the worship of Shiva through Diksha. And they followed the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shasana. And this is just a recap from last week. There's a general revelation, Samaya, and also a particular revelation, Vishesha. Samaya is everyone shares that revelation, the Vedas and the Puranas, and the Vishesha is the particular revelation for some groups. And you get into this through Diksha, through initiation. So in contrast to kind of yoga practitioners, where you have to have yoga and meditate and put effort in, the tantric groups tended to say that's not what gets you liberated, it's initiation liberates you. So you get initiated, and at death, you'll go to liberation. And the more extreme groups, this diksha meant possession by the goddess. You had to become, show signs of possession. So we've looked at the Atimarga Mantramarga distinction, and the Atimargas compose a number of sects, particularly the Pashupatas. We looked at all that last time, just to recap there. And Lakulisha was the guru of that sect, could have been a historical figure, but he was said to be the corpse of a Brahmin. Shiva entered the corpse of a Brahmin, animated the corpse, and then the Brahmin gave the teachings. And that's the Lakulishas. The Lakulishas carried a skull-topped staff, Kadvanga, which is what Shiva carries, and a skull begging bowl. So Shiva, in the form of a wandering mendicant, a beggar, takes that form with a dog. And they carry, the garment of human bones, matted hair, an imitation of Rudra, or a shaved head. And they've taken the Mahavrata, the great vow of killing a Brahmin. And there's that myth that I mentioned of Shiva kills Brahma, cuts off his head with his thumb, and his thumb sticks to his hand. And then it falls after 12 years of the Kapala Mochana Tirtha in Varanasi. And then the Pashupatas and the Lakulishas are the predecessors of the Kalamukhas, who were again very powerful in Karnataka, and the Karpalikas. And they're the forerunners of the modern Agoris in Benares. And there's a modern Agori. Not a very good one, picture of it, but he's drinking out of his skull. I mean, it's a bit staged, but he's drinking out of a skull, and he's got a picture of Shiva behind him. And he's got his jaba, his matted hair on top of his head. He's got the cremation ground ash. And there's a good book by Jonathan Parry called Death in Benares, and there's an interesting chapter on the modern Agoris in Benares, the contemporary Agoris. It's become appropriated by the Indian middle classes now, the Agori tradition. Now, going backwards, the Shaiva Siddhanta is a householder tradition, so they're not particularly into the Agori Karpalika type thing, so it's fairly orthodox, but they revere the tantras as revelation, and this is the fundamental Shaiva system, as Mahayana Buddhism is a fundamental Buddhist system for the Vajrayana. So the Shaiva Siddhanta is a fundamental Shaiva system for the other non Siddhantika systems. And there's lots of theologians here, but particularly Sadyojyoti, Bhattanarayana Kanta, and his son Rama Kanta, all big theologians, mainly in Kashmir and also in Chidambaram in the south. And it spread south to the Tamil country. Bhojadeva, King Bhoja, who was also a poet, 11th century, very famous theologian and poet. Soma Shambhu, who wrote a great thick ritual manual, Soma Shambhu Padati, which has got a French translation by Helene Brunner, and Agora Shiva, another famous theologian. And all of these believed in The best, probably the best English book on some of this is Richard Davis's book, Ritual in an Oscillating Universe, which is actually based on Helen Brunner's work, I think. But Helen Brunner has done this four-volume translation of the Soma Shambhupada Deep. And they believe in three ontological categories: the Lord Pati, the Bond Pasha, which is the universe, and the Soul Pashu, the beast. So the cow or the beast is grasped by the rope, the Pasha, the bond of the universe. And these are three eternally distinct, ontologically distinct categories.
And this is the soul of a human being as opposed to the soul of Parapurusha.
Yeah, so, yeah, your soul, my soul, animal souls, that's right. Yeah, individual souls. And the Pati, the Lord, who is Shiva, has five acts. What is Shiva? Shiva is he who performs five acts. It's the soul. Shiva is a soul that performs these five acts of creation, creates the universe. Doesn't really create it because it's already eternally existent, but he acts. There's a substance called Bindu. Bindu means drop. It means point, actually. And Shiva acts upon the Bindu, and the Bindu then unfolds as the universe. So creation, Srishti, in a sense creation, but it's really acting on pre-existing matter. Maintenance, Shiva maintains the universe, and finally he withdraws or destroys the universe. And that's where you get the dancing Shiva, destroying the universe. Although I'm destroying the universe, don't be afraid, he says. And the fourth function is concealing himself. He conceals himself from devotees and reveals himself, anugraha, through grace.
Is that fourth and fifth, or just fourth?
Fourth is concealing, fifth is revealing.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what was revealing?
He reveals himself.
Anugraha, sorry.
Yeah, anugraha. Anugraha.
Anugraha.
Yeah.
And concealment is
Tirudana. Hides himself and reveals himself from devotees. And the bond then is the universe. And in the Shaiva Siddhanta conceptualization, the universe comprises many different bhuvanas, many different worlds or levels, which you can't see. You can see this world, but there are other worlds you can't see according to them. They're in a hierarchy, arranged in a hierarchy of levels.
Ontological worlds or
physical? Yeah.
Ontological.
Yeah. But you're places you can go to in your meditation and after death. And there are 36 levels of reality, according to them, tattvas, which are the constituents of the cosmos. And their cosmos is divided into these three levels: pure creation, mixed creation, and impure creation. And we're in the impure creation. I won't go through all of these, but just say there's 36 tattvas. You recognise these from Purusha. These ones here, 24, are the same as the Samkhya tattvas: the Purusha, the soul, the Prakriti, matter, and out from Prakriti evolves Buddhi, the higher mind or intellect, the I-ness. The mind, the manas, the five senses, the five action capacities, five subtle elements, five gross elements. That's all Samkhya. Now the Shaivas come along and say, actually we've got these 11 further categories. We go beyond Samkhya, we've got 11 more tattvas than them. And Maya is the... Let's start at the top. Shiva. Shiva's not Shiva, the god Shiva. Shiva Tattva is regarded as the top of the material universe, as it were. But it's not Shiva, the god, Shiva Tattva, Shiva and Shakti. And Shiva and Shakti are the potential, if you like, of the cosmos, which evolve into Sadar Shiva. And Sadar Shiva is the five-headed form of Shiva that's worshipped by the Shaiva Siddhanta. He's the main focus of worship of the Shaiva Siddhanta. And the
Could you say that again, please, about
Sadashiva? Yes, Sadashiva is the main focus of worship of the Shaiva Siddhanta, the iconic representation of Shiva.
It's on five axe forms, is it?
Oh, yeah, he's got five heads, that's right. The five heads before the five axe, yeah. And he emanates lower form Ishvara, and who emanates Shuddhavidya. And then below them, you've got Maya, which means illusion, but it's kind of magical show, if you like. And out from Maya develops these five coverings of the soul called Kala, which is authorship, particularity of authorship. So when I perform an action, it's Kala that's performing an action. Vidya, limited knowledge. Raga, passion. Karma, time. Just shows you the importance of these different kala and kala, different words. And niyati, fate, or causal restriction. So these are forces that kick in at that level of the universe.
Sorry, could you say that again? I'm writing it down. Kala is authorship?
Kala means power or particularity of authorship. So, agency. Vidya is knowledge, but limited knowledge, not higher knowledge. Raga is passion. So these are the coverings of the soul. Kala is time. And niyati is sometimes translated as fate, but it's like causal restriction. So these are all the limitations of the purusha, the kaichuka of the coverings of the soul. It's a slightly forced thing because you've got these 24 Samkhya categories and you've got these 11 Shaiva ones and they're just kind of stuck on the top. But they're integrated in quite an interesting way in the text and so on. And these are, you know, this is an explanation or a description of the universe, but they're also used in rituals, so an important ritual because they're mapped onto the body. And then linked to that, you've got these seven types of persons, seven types of experience in the Shaiva Siddhanta. You've got this Shiva is a top dog. He's the highest kind of agent, the highest kind of experience. But you've got these other six kinds below Shiva. It's terribly, I don't know why they made it so complicated, but they just... Well, I think that you've got these different systems that are operating independently, and they're trying to bring them all together, trying to fit them all in together. And I think they're a bit bored with these problems because they don't have to work, probably. You know. They've got jobs. So the Vidyeshwaras and the Mantra Maheshwaras are the beings who correspond to the level of Sadashiva. And Sadashiva doesn't create the universe directly. He gets one of these eight Vidyeshwaras to do it. And Ananta is the top dog of the eight Vidyeshwaras who creates the universe.
Which is Ananta, sorry?
He's one of the... There are eight of these characters.
Eight of those, yes.
And he's the top dog of the eight Vidyeshwaras, the lords of knowledge. Or the Mantra Maheshwaras, the great lords of mantra. And then underneath them you get millions of Mantreshwaras, lords of mantra, and then you get beings called mantras, and they all exist in the pure realm, in the pure course. And they're gods, they're deities really. So the interesting, they should be called mantras, because so when you repeat a mantra, its source of energy, its power comes from the mantras up in the higher pure realms of the cosmos. And then lower down, underneath them, you've got these other kinds of beings, Vijnana Kalas, those who have only consciousness, the Vijnana consciousness, the Jnana Kevala as consciousness only. And there are three impurities that beings possess in the lower universe: individuality, karma, and delusion, maya. And they only have individuality as their impurity. So they're higher beings, and higher than us, but lower than the mantras. And then you get the pralaya kalas, again higher beings, who have the individuality and karma. And they go into a state. The pralaya means the disillusion. So the bindu manifests itself in the pure creation, and then it goes into the mixed creation. So the bindu, the lower reflection of the bindu, is the maya, and the lower reflection of maya is prakriti. So you get these levels upon levels. But why am I telling you this? The pralaya kalas, at the end of a, when they die, when they could be lower, like you and me, but when we die, if we've done enough meditation and so on, we can become a pralaya kala, in which case you go to the top of this level, the top of maya. But you don't go into the pure realms, and you can live in that level just there for a long, long time. But eventually, your karma will get used up, and you'll get reborn in the lower levels again. And the sakala are the ordinary people, like you and me, animals, crows, dogs, cats, flies. They're all sakalas. And they have individuality, karma, and delusion. So these are the seven types of experience. So now the doctrines of the Shaiva Siddhanta are that the goal of life is liberation, and liberation means equality with Shiva, Shiva Tulya. So because you're ontologically distinct, you can't become Shiva, but you can become like Shiva. And the only difference is between a liberated soul and Shiva is that Shiva performs the five acts, whereas a liberated soul doesn't. And liberated soul was bound. So there's equality with Shiva, Shiva Tulya, but not identity. You don't merge with Shiva, you don't become one with Shiva. And you get liberated through the grace of Shiva, through the anugraha. And this is manifested, this grace is manifested through initiation, diksha, by the guru. And Shiva enters into the guru in initiation. And you get that ritual that I'll tell you about in a minute, whereby the soul is purified by the guru. And in the Shaiva Siddhanta, it's gender restricted, so the initiation is restricted to men. It's not in the non-Shaitantika tradition, but it is in the Shaiva Siddhanta. And you don't get rid of caste through initiation, whereas you do in the other more extreme traditions. And women participate in this vicariously through their husbands. So if your husband gets initiation and goes up to heaven, he gets there, but he pulls you with him if you're a woman. And there are different types of initiation. There's a common initiation that everyone goes through, Samaya. And there's the liberating liberation, the Nirvana Diksha, where you're guaranteed liberation. And there are different rituals associated with these. And in Nirvana Diksha, the guru takes a string, the length of your body, and identifies the 36 tattvas with the string, and then cuts it and burns the bits in a fire. symbolically destroying your body and yourself, and recreating you in this new form, the form of Shiva. And most Chandra Siddhantins would get the Samaya Diksha and the Nirvana Diksha together and follow that until they died, in which case they would achieve Shiva Tulya through their actions and through the grace of the Lord. And they made a distinction between those who want liberation, the Mumukshu, and those who want power, the Mumukshu. So if you're only interested in liberation, Mumukshu, you might become a teacher in the tradition and take a further consecration called the Acharya Abhishika, the sprinkling. But if you wanted power, you would undergo a further consecration called the Sadaka Abhishika, and become a Sadaka. So the Sadaka was a technical term for a Mumukshu, somebody seeking power and pleasure in higher worlds, before they got liberated. Now, it's really a waste of time in a sense. What's the point of becoming a Mumukshu, really, if when liberation is the goal?
Is a sadhaka someone who does sadhana?
Yes.
So, but you say it's linked with someone who wants Mumukshu?
Sadhana, the word sadhaka has often become a kind of just a general name for a practitioner, but mm-hmm. originally it had a technical meaning of somebody who was a bhavukshu, who was seeking power. There's an interesting article.
Sorry, that's sadhaka or sadhana?
Sadhaka. Sadhana is what a sadhaka does. The goal, the sadhya. So the sadhaka performs sadhana to reach sadhya, the goal.
So one is practice, the other is the practitioner.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, sadhya is the object of practice, sadhana is the practice, and sadhaka is the person who does the practice, yeah. And there's a ritual process. Having undergone this initiation, the Shaiva Siddhantin would have to three times a day at the sandhyas, at the junctures, evening, morning and noon, would have to perform this ritual, the purification of the elements of the body after bathing, the Bhuta Shuddhi, creating a divine body through imposing mantras upon it. You probably do it quite quickly after a while. Mental worship, so you visualise God in your heart and you bring Sadar Shiva down into your heart and worship him in your heart, on a throne that you create there. Followed by external worship, worshipping a Shivalinga and giving flowers and incense and so on to the Shivalinga. That's okay. Mental inner worship. So, yeah, this is just standard tantric practice, really. That's contained in all of the different traditions. The Pancharatra follow this as well. And the deities are different. So the Bhuta Shuddhi, you identify the body with the universe and then dissolve the universe within it. Or you visualize a fire burning up from the toe of the right foot, Kalagni, the fire of time, burns the body to a pile of ashes, which is then washed away in your imagination by your mantras. Then create a divine body and so on. Do the inner worship and the external worship. I gave you a translation last week of the Manasa Yaga from the Pancharatra tradition, the Jayaka Samhita, but it's virtually the same in the Shaiva tradition as well. Now, tantric prayer is important in all of this. And the visualized deity, the god you visualize, Sadar Shiva or whoever it is also a mantra. And the mantra is said to be the body of the god. So when you repeat the mantra, you're embodying the body of the god. You're taking the body of the god into you, as it were.
This is the internalization.
Yeah, the internalization. Yeah. And you've got to, the practitioner must become a deity to worship a deity and a Shaiva, and the tantric systems do really. And this is even the case for metaphysically dualistic systems, such as the Shaiva Siddhanta. Yes, so the mantra is the body of the deity. So Sadar Shiva, who is the main focus of worship of the Shaiva Siddhanta, he's Panchamukha, he's got five faces. And each of his faces is a different deity, he's got a different name. And there are mantras that come, different mantras that are associated with the five faces of Shiva. So depending on your initiation, when you're initiated, you throw a flower into the mandala. You're blindfolded, you throw a flower in. And when the flower lands, that's going to be your mantra that you'll repeat. And it'll be one of the mantras of the five faces of Shiva. So, for example, Tat Purusha. Om Namah Tat Purushaya. Om Pat. Might be the mantra that you have to repeat. Maladeva. Agupa. Can't remember the other two off the top of my head. But anyway, so whoever, there are five faces, and you repeat one of the mantras from the five faces. You can check out these details in them.
I'm just thinking of one of Tatpurjaya Ritmahe Mahavidevaya.
Look, there you are.
Is that the one?
That could be that one, yeah.
Do you repeat five mantras for each of the faces?
No, just one mantra.
Just one
mantra. Yeah, for each of the faces. And there's a hymn by a god of Shiva called Hymn to the Five Wings of Deity, the Panchavarana Stotra, which describes the tantric prayer, really, the visualization of these deities and the mantras associated with them. So you've got the Sadar Shiva in the center, and you've got these retinues of deities outside, five rings of deities outside, which reflects the temple. So in the temple, you've got Sadar Shiva in the form of a linga in the Garbha Griha of the temple, and then you've got the main temple body there. And at the doors of the temple, you've got the guardians, the Lokapalas, ferocious Lokapalas. I've got some photographs of them, I should have brought them off. Oh, that's Shaiva Siddhanta finished. We've got time for this. Any points about Shaiva Siddhanta before I kind of go off from there? So this is normative Shaivism. It's in South India now, so it's the main tradition of Shaivism in South India. But it got influenced with Tamil Bhakti, devotionalism in Tamil. So Chidambaram on the east coast is a big centre of Shaiva Siddhanta, and always has been since the medieval period. And there they have a dancing Shiva image. So Agora Shiva and Bhojadeva were at Chidambaram. Now moving further towards the other side, you've got some texts and traditions were between the Shaiva Siddhanta orthodoxy and the heterodox Kalma and Shaiva traditions, which I'll be speaking about next time. And there's one text which is quite interesting called the Nature Tantra, which is composed between 700 and 850 BC, and it's operating in the courts of the king, particularly in Kashmir and also Nepal, because we've got manuscripts from Nepal. And this is devotion to a god called Nature, the Eye, or the Lord of Immortality, Amriteshvara, also known as Mrityunjaya, the Conqueror of Death. And the mantra here is Om Jum Sa, the shorter version. That's the liberating mantra. And there's a commentary on this text by the non-dualist Kshema Raja. So it's between the dualism of the Shaiva Siddhanta and the non-dualism of the Kashmiri Shaivas. And there's Amriteshvara there with his goddess Amrita Lakshmi. So there's lots of representations from the medieval period of these deities. So it was obviously quite a big kind of cult at the time.
What does Om Jum Sa translate?
Om Jum Sa, it doesn't mean anything.
Sa.
Sa, yeah. He, perhaps Sahi. Om Jum Sa. Seed syllables. Tantric mantras. So you repeat Om Jum Sa and visualize. In your mind, you visualize Nature Mata, and then do a puja to an image like this of Nature Mata outside of yourself. It's the Nature Nata, the Nature Tantra, Kashmir. And in that text, you've got these different visualizations of the body and the Sukshma Dhyana, the subtle visualization, is an interesting one, where the body is a symbolic system and is arranged in a vertical axis containing these centers of power called chakras, or also supports or dharas. Lots of different names for these levels of the body. Of the body of the god that you then identify with in your meditation. So the body is made to correspond to the cosmos. And this is the basis of these later traditions. Here's a 18th century chakra man from Rajasthan. And he's got seven chakras there. That became standardized after the 11th century. The Nature Tantra doesn't contain the same levels, the same names, but this got standardized and made famous in the West by Arthur Avalon in his The Serpent Power. So you've got Shiva and Shakti, or Amriteshvara and Lakshmi at the top of the head. Oh dear.
Well, it's
clever,
isn't it?
It's very clever. I don't know how you go backwards. How do you go backwards? Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Anyway. Sorry, there we are. And that became a standard yogic thing, wider than the tantric traditions and pan-Hindu, really. And now you can now it's all pervasive in the West as well. You can go and have your chakras balanced for a small fee in a Yellow Pages. They're advertising that somewhere. So going back to the pattern of the traditions. We've looked at the Shaiva Siddhanta. The Nature Tantra is kind of between the non-Siddhantic groups and the Shaiva Siddhanta. And next time we're going to look at the non-Siddhantic groups and or Kashmir Shaivism, and the philosophical expression of that in what's called the recognition school in the Pratyabhidhi. I've got nothing else to say today.
That high rabbi, isn't he the dark aspect of Shiva, the one who walks around with manifests as a black dog, and he is connected with death, but he's also immensely benevolent?
Yeah, he's a ferocious form of Shiva.
Ferocious.
Yeah, it's got fangs.
Yeah, they worship Shiva as Sadar Shiva and also the Shiva Linga. And this lot worship Shiva as Bhairava, ferocious, his bulging eyes, and his fangs. Thanks, everyone. Oh dear, how do I get out of this?
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I quite like this PowerPoint business. I've never really done it properly in the past.
Maybe this is the Cory
Burke
thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
It could be, couldn't it? Yeah. It's clever stuff, isn't it? Oh, look, you can even erase things. You can draw on the board.
Can I ask a question? I'm being a bit pedantic here, but that's not helping. Why is the non-Siddhanta Bhairava connected with the non-dualist and the
say that again. Why is it ferocious?
Non-Siddhanta, the worship of
Bhairava
connected with one reality, whereas the Siddhanta, the dualist, with
Sadhana
Shiva. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. Why do they worship the...
Why is Bhairava to do with non-dualism and Sadhana Shiva with dualism?
Right? Yeah, you got that right, yeah.
It's obscure to me.
I think it's that Sadar Shiva was a normative worship of Shiva, and these more extreme cults, they worshipped a ferocious Shiva because they were against the orthodoxy, and so a ferocious form of Shiva manifested their objection, probably. And the ferocious form of Shiva cuts through and destroys inhibition, which is characterized by inhibition, shankar.
And dualism.
Yeah, and
right
dualism.
And wrong.
That's right. It cuts through right and wrong, yeah. So that's why he's ferocious. Right.